Hello, listeners. Welcome to the Strength in Recovery podcast. We have a special guest with us today. I'm joined by Bill Petrosky. He is an alum of our Monroeville location and agreed to speak with us today just about his recovery, a new nonprofit that he's developed, and what recovery and what life is like now. So thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Tell us a little bit about yourself and how you came to RCA.
In 2021, I was diagnosed with liver cancer. After suffering from esophageal varices, all the blood vessels in my throat exploded from the use of alcohol. And whenever I was diagnosed with liver cancer, I was put on the transplant list, but continued to drink. So I got knocked off the transplant list because you can't do both. So I knew that I needed to do something about this issue if I wanted to live. And that's when I found RCA and I agreed to the outpatient program, which I took advantage of not having to be present. I took advantage of the Zoom. I was still drinking while I was on doing the groups because I was Zooming it. So the counselor here that was leading the group kind of knew what was going on. She had talked to my girlfriend in the past and had great communication with her. And she called me out and made me come in one day and told me that she felt I needed more help than outpatient. And I agreed and I walked on in.
Now, what's that conversation like? And you were telling us a little bit last night. So you're going to these groups, you were going in person, you realize there's a virtual option and you're like, oh, that's going to work for me.
Yeah, and that's what addicts do.
And I can still skirt the issue and drink during the day.
Yeah, I can make my family be so proud of me for going to outpatient rehab, but yet.
And someone decides, the counselor calls and says, what's up?
Yeah.
What's that moment like?
She's smarter than I think. You know, it's just like, but at the same time, it's like she cares.
Yeah. And are you relieved that somebody's finally?
1,000%. Yeah. Yeah. I had a good relationship with the counselor coming in. Mm-hmm. She was very good at what she does, but yet very stern. And she's only about 4'7", but she's a firecracker. Mm-hmm. And to this day, I don't come here without popping my head in her office and saying hi or getting a hug. And it made a difference.
And this month, you're celebrating 1 year?
No, last month.
Last month.
Yeah, August 24th, I celebrated 1 year.
That's amazing.
Yes. I mean, there's no other way I could put it because I've celebrated a year before that really wasn't all that. There was cheating involved and I still pretended like I wasn't drinking and just took advantage of everything. And like I was like, hey, look, I celebrated 1 year. I really didn't, but I told everybody I had 1 year and I went out and bought a Harley. Like I deserve something. I didn't deserve nothing. I lied my way through a year because I was still hiding it. But this time was different.
Talk a little bit about that.
What I learned here, just walking in the door and the compassion you get from others, the way that employees here can recognize with what you're going through and be so compassionate about it and not make you feel out of place where society puts you in a perspective of being labeled. You know, we're normal people. We just had a problem.
Now, how long did it take for you to realize that drinking was a problem? Was it the cancer diagnosis? Was it...
It was COVID in general. I mean, I had health issues during COVID, but I also got separated early March of 2020. And Then August 16th, my mother passed away while she was basically getting ready to make breakfast for everyone. We had a birthday party for my son the day before. She said breakfast tomorrow morning. We were all up at our camp. And I said, me and George are going to go fishing because we grew up fishing. And George is my son. And me and him were out on the boat. And it was just before 9 o'clock and my phone was ringing. And I looked over at my phone and it said, Mom. And I said, there's Grandma getting ready to yell at us because we're not back for for breakfast. And I started laughing. And when I answered the phone, it was my neighbor. And she said, you got to get here as quick as you can. Your mom's face down on the floor. And when we got there, she was gone. Sausage was in the sink thawing out.
I'm so sorry.
Thanks. Yeah. She had a massive heart attack.
And your background is?
CPR and first aid.
And you know.
And I wasn't there. Ugh. I live with that every day.
I'm so sorry. And so then, you're dealing with those emotions, your mom's death.
And I just got, I don't even think I grieved my mother much because I went right to alcohol. And my dad, when I did get separated, I moved in with my parents, but I was working from home because of COVID. Basically putting fires out at work, we called it. If they needed me, I had to go in. I worked at wastewater treatment plant for 23 years. And my job was pre-treatment. I was down in manholes all day. And we went down to Skeleton Cruise and I was on the phone and answering emails as much as I could just to try to keep everything flowing, literally. So living with my parents, but they weren't there. And then because all summer they would be up at camp. And I brought my dad home that day and, you know, I finally started to realize he's never wrote a check. He's never paid a bill. He has no idea what kind of debt they have. And I was there and I got, I don't want to say wrapped up into it, but like I started trying to figure everything out, you know. We're going to the funeral home, we're making arrangements, calling family, everything we had to do.
The work. That's around that can be enormous.
Yeah. And then in the drop of a hat, it all goes away. The family leaves. The visitors leave. Mm-hmm. The day she was buried, we had a big thing in the backyard for a wake. My dad stressed no alcohol. I had it hidden everywhere in the house. Mm-hmm. And as people trickled out, that was it. It was me and him. Yeah. And I just went every day. But it was like I took advantage of his vulnerability at the time. Because him and my mom just celebrated 50 years in April. They couldn't have we wanted to have a big anniversary party. It didn't happen because of COVID. And he lost his best friend. I mean, they did everything together. If she went and got her hair done, he waited in a car so they could go to a store afterwards, mm-hmm. if she wanted to, or to dinner. Mm-hmm. They were always together. They were inseparable for 50 years. And he's there, you know, I didn't want to go to work because I didn't want him to be alone. Mm-hmm. And knowing that he was just not in the right state, it made it easier. I showered at work because I told you I was down in manholes all day. I'm not going to get in my truck or come home. Mm-hmm. So I always had a backpack. And before I would get home, I would dump a 15-pack in the backpack and just walk upstairs. And then throughout the night go up, I would always buy the little airplanes and had them in my backpack. And I just pretended like he ain't going to know what's going on because his mind is occupied.
And your mind at that point, are you thinking I have a problem and I'm hiding it, or I'm okay because I'm still going to work?
I don't think whenever you have a problem like that, you ever think you have a problem. Mm-hmm. you could have came right up to me and said you have a problem, and I would have been like, no, I'm going to work tomorrow. I'm a functioning guy. Mm-hmm. I was a functioning alcoholic. It got to the point where if I bought a 15-pack on the way home and a couple of airplanes, I would make sure there was a couple left so that I could have a beer to brush my teeth with and a couple drinks on my way to work. And I was driving a company vehicle with a government plate on it. Thankfully, I was, well, I don't want to say thankfully, but I made it to retirement. Mm-hmm. I got forced into retirement because I couldn't work around the infection and be on the transplant list. Mm-hmm. So after I did my 30 days and I stayed in contact with my liver doctor and the transplant team.
You did 30 days.
31.
Of?
Inpatient.
Inpatient.
Yeah. And I stayed in contact while I was here, or my girlfriend did, and with my liver doctor and the transplant team, and they seen my progression.
Wow.
When I got out, first thing was blood work, and it showed there's something in blood that you could tell if you had a drink in 30 days mm-hmm. or 3 months, and it showed it on a decline, and it's stayed that way for a year. And 6 months ago, I was reintroduced to the transplant team, and I got back on the list.
Wow.
So, I get an MRI and an ultrasound every 3 months, and I get my throat scoped every three months.
So you first go, you get this diagnosis. When does the diagnosis happen? Your mom's passed away, you're helping care for your dad,
mm-hmm.
and you get this diagnosis.
December 9th of 21.
21.
What happened was we were going to Latrobe Airport because we have friends that live in Florida. And whenever we see Spirit offer some stupid deal, you save $40 by buying them over the counter.
Yeah.
So I said, where we live in the South Hills, I'm more towards the Century 3 area for anybody listening that might be in Pittsburgh. There's nothing around. Mm-hmm. So I told my girlfriend, my fiance now, but my girlfriend at mm-hmm. the time, if we go get plane tickets at La Trobe and save the $40, we could shop our way back because there's a bunch of plazas. And it was Christmas. We were Christmas shopping.
Wow.
So that was December 9th. And we were leaving, like, on our way out, I didn't feel good. I was driving, but I just didn't feel right.
Mm-hmm.
And it was like almost like I had the flu.
Mm-hmm.
And then right away, everybody's like, you got COVID. I'm like, no, it's not. It's nothing like that. So we went to a couple of stores. I don't even remember being there. And I wasn't drinking.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember we went to Dick's Sporting Goods. And when we were leaving, when we walked out, I asked her. I said, could we just go home? I'm done. I don't feel good. And she said, fine, whatever. And I said, will you drive my truck home? I was like, I just can't. So she backed out of the parking spot and we're going through the parking lot and I felt the urge like I was going to vomit and I opened up the door and I vomited a little bit and I opened my eyes. I looked at the running board on my truck and it was covered in blood.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't say anything. She works in healthcare. She did at the time. She don't know more. So I knew if I was going to say anything to her, she's going to go insane. So we went home and I laid down and periodically throughout the day, it would repeat itself. And I remember at night, it was later on that evening, maybe around 9 or 10 o'clock, it just felt like my mouth was filling up with fluid and I had to get rid of it. Like my cheeks were filling up, I looked like a chipmunk and I didn't get it. It's like not like you're dry heaving where you're going to vomit. It's just like I had to get rid of what was in my mouth. So I ran to the bathroom and it was just all blood. And she walked in behind me and she said, you are going to the hospital now. So I went to the hospital. They rushed me into emergency surgery. I was literally signing the anesthesia paperwork while I was being wheeled into the operating room.
Mm-hmm.
And I was in emergency surgery for 7 hours. And when I was done, the doctor walked out and she said, he told her, if she would have waited 10 more minutes, I was done. I was gone. All the blood vessels in my throat exploded. I had esophageal varices, and it was from alcohol. It was from the airplanes more than the beer. They just took away the lining of my throat.
I think a lot of people talk about liver disease, not very many people talk about.
Right, esophageal varices. And it's deadly. And so they banned all of my blood vessels. And I had to go, like, I probably had, at this time, probably 30 throat scopes. And each, like, maybe every other one, they're still banding blood vessels in my throat. And, but while I was in there, I was hospitalized for 10 days. I had 7 blood transfusions because of the amount of blood that I lost. And they ran a bunch of other tests. So the doctor came in before I was discharged and said, I need you to go see a liver doctor. Mm-hmm. And I said, okay. I kind of figured I beat it up a little bit throughout my life. And he said, no, he goes, you have end-stage liver disease, severe cirrhosis, and stage 3 liver cancer. So that's whenever I went to see the liver doctor. But if I had not had that esophageal varices, I may have never known I had cancer.
Yeah.
So
you're here for a reason.
Yeah, so far.
And we get this diagnosis, and you're thinking at that point, well, I just have to stop at drinking, or?
I walked out of there saying, that's it. I can't do this no more. And then my fiance had it was probably a little over a year after that. I'm going through radiation. I drank before I went to radiation. And I had to lay in a body cast. They did invasive radiation. They wrapped me with like saran wrap, put a shop vac on it, and sucked all the air out of it. Like, I couldn't wiggle my toes. The body cast was molded to be. I had to go there one day and get fitted. And they made a body cast, and they would throw it up on a table when I got there. I laid in it, and they put me through the tube, and they measured your breathing in a practice run. And they measured what you exhale. Mm-hmm. And you had to hit that number during your treatment. So they would tell you, are you ready? And you're like, yeah. And they would be like, breathe. And you exhaled until you had to hit this. If you didn't hit that number, they had to redo it. Mm-hmm. And you did this for an hour. And I did it for 4 weeks the first time and 4 weeks the second time. And I drank one time going into radiation. And so that was one of the cheats that I had, I guess, during my quote-unquote year of sobriety.
Mm-hmm. So you're on this transplant list, and the doctor says, we have to remove you. That's got to be a tough moment.
And I almost got removed the second time. Not my fault. But if you want to throw every possibility of a relapse at me, just keep them coming. Because whenever I was forced into disability retirement because of the infection risk, after I signed my retirement papers, I went to my office and I was boxing stuff up. And I was like, oh, you know what? I got shower towels probably hanging in my locker. So I went to my locker and I opened it up and I'm getting stuff out of my locker and putting it in a garbage bag or whatever. And my phone rings and it says AHN, Allegheny Health Network. So I'm like, okay. It was the transplant coordinator that I talked to often. Mm-hmm. And she said, Bill, what's going on? And I go, nothing. Why? And she said, because your transplant's coming up denied due to insurance. And I said, what are you talking about? She said, I have no idea. I said, hold on a minute. So I called, I called HR and I said, you know, I just got this phone call from AHN and they're denying my transplant. And they were like, yeah, whenever you take disability retirement, you lose your health insurance. And I'm like,
no one mentioned that.
I've talked to people that work there recently that don't know that's a thing. And they've been there 20 plus years. I said, I had no idea. No preparation for that whatsoever. So I finished doing what I was doing. I rushed home. And now I'm like, I have to find health insurance. So I started calling around. And you could not call an insurance broker and get insurance and have some past health condition covered. So there's a site called Penny, and I went on Penny, and I ended up getting covered, but I pay out of pocket, and I never paid a dime for my health insurance.
Wow.
But I got covered by Penny, and I called the train, and everything's good. But it was just like, what other curveball can you throw at me?
Yeah. So you come in, you're here for outpatient, you're kind of phoning it in, so to speak. They call you on it.
Phoning the phony.
And you don't even go home?
No.
They just say, you need to go upstairs.
I said, when I walked in, somebody instantly said, take his keys. And I'm like, what? Mm. You know, nobody's touching my keys. And so the two people got up and moved, and I sat down. And the counselor said, do you think what we're offering here in outpatient is enough? And I said, if you're asking me that question, I'm assuming you already know the answer. Mm. And she said, I just want to hear it from you. And I said, maybe I do need more help. And she says, well, what steps do you want to take? And there's other people that in the group that stayed in the room, and they were like, you know, it takes a lot to walk in by yourself, and it would mean a lot. And they're like, you know, you got this, you could do it. And I said to her, I said, could you do me one favor? And she said, what's that? I said, could I go out to my truck and make a couple phone calls? Because I want to let people know what's going on. And she said, absolutely. And I walked out to my truck, and I never took my phone out of my pocket. I finished all the Fireball I had in my truck, and then I walked into inpatient.
Wow. And what's that like, getting to the...
Walking into... I've never been to a facility. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they register you, they take your picture.
If someone was scared, they're like, there's no way I can do that. What would you tell them?
Do it. It's nothing.
And you were describing last night just how welcoming...
Yeah. Like...
the community is in treatment.
Exactly. And so, like, I didn't... And I'm sure this isn't everywhere or even every RCA facility, but whenever they take you out of the nurse's station and put you in scrubs and make sure you don't have any drugs on you or anything like that, the nurse said, okay, let me walk you to your room. And we're going to go up this elevator. And I didn't realize whenever you got... I didn't know anything. I didn't know there was a community room, let alone whenever the elevator doors open, I'm going to be in it. There was no groups going on at the time. They were in between. Mm-hmm. So everybody was in the community room. And this elevator door opens, and I'm just like...
So you're like, welcome to treatment.
Here I am. Yeah. And I'm just like, oh my God, you instantly like look around and start judging people like, oh God, I'm not going to get along with you. I hope, you know, you're picturing like four bunk beds in a room that you're going to have to sleep with these people. And I'm like, you're probably going to snore. I don't like you. And it's not like that at all. You come in here, they show you a room. It's like a hotel. I remember walking out of my room and there was a guy standing up at the nurse's station, and he was like, hey, my name's so-and-so. He was like, this is where all the groups are and what time. They'll put you with a counselor, and you'll follow his lead on some groups. This is the cafeteria menu. If you don't like what they're having, you could substitute it with grilled cheese or whatever. Just make sure you have the paperwork filled out by 10 a.m., blah, blah, blah. And I thought he worked there, and he didn't. He was a patient.
Just helping
and
you
I'm
feel
just,
welcome.
Yeah, just automatically. And I'm like, wow, this is amazing. Because I still didn't know that he didn't work there until I seen him in a group. Mm-hmm. Sitting in a chair like I'm sitting in. And like, everybody introduced themselves. And then you realize everybody's there for the same reason. Mm-hmm. You're no different than them.
And you don't feel that
you
sense
don't
of shame
feel it, no.
or judgment.
Without a doubt. The only thing that they have on you is they already know that we're all there for the same reason. I didn't know, like, I knew that walking in, but I didn't feel it mm-hmm. until I got there.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So it's like...
And
it's like
so much of a addiction and alcoholism is isolating. It gets you in your truck by yourself. It gets you... maybe at your hobby's fishing. Fishing alone and... just that sense of isolation. So I'm sure that can be a little bit intimidating to go, oh no, I have to deal with people.
Right.
but yet it becomes a lifeline at the same time.
Yeah. The patients at any recovery center can't wait for the new guy to walk in to show them the way. Mm. Because they were that person yesterday or a week ago or a month ago. And they can't wait to make sure that that person feels just as welcome as they did when they get off that elevator.
Wow. And then, too, you've been a real special part of our alumni association here at Monroeville.
I don't miss.
Talk a little bit about the alumni community. I think that really, and this podcast isn't designed to just tout RCA. It's more about recovery. But I think that is what sets RCA apart, is just our commitment and RCA's investment in the alumni.
Yeah, it keeps people together. Without that, there is no recovery for a lot of people.
You come back here every week.
Every Tuesday. And I bring my dad with me. And it changed his whole perspective on addiction. Hmm. And
talk a little bit about that. So you have your dad. You guys are grieving together. You're going through extreme loss, trying to rebuild life. And then he is now faced with knowing his son is up against the most deadly.
He knew I drank a lot
of addiction.
There was no hiding it. I mean, my dad's worked in and out of law enforcement all his life, private security companies. He's not a dummy. Mm-hmm. But and he knew that. I mean, he knew Thanksgiving Day, whenever I went to take the roaster out of the oven and without pot holders, that something was wrong. Mm-hmm. You know, and it was just one of them. I keep running upstairs. And he got onto that. Mm. You know, why does he keep going up there? What's up there? I know what he's doing. But he was a beer after cutting the grass guy. Mm-hmm. He was a Jack and Coke on Friday night guy. There's no addiction in my family. I don't recall anyone that had an addiction problem. My dad's dad owned a bar, but he also had a full-time job. My dad's mom was a nurse, but she bartended at the bar when need be. 1963, a tornado came through and knocked the bar down and killed my grandfather. Mm. So I never even met him, but people say I remind them a lot of him. Wow. But, so there's no addiction issues, and I have a problem that I'm faced with fixing, and I come to RCA because he knew something was going on, and he said it was the best worst day of his life that I was walking into inpatient, because one of the reasons I didn't want to go to inpatient was my dad being home alone. And I always worried about him, you know. And he's a grown man. But I just worry. To this day, I'm like, do you eat anything? You know, like, he's like, I'll eat, don't worry about it. But,
So coming here with you.
So, yeah, on Tuesday
for
nights.
Support groups.
Yeah, and whenever I was inpatient, he came for every visitation. My fiance came, my son came a couple times. You see family invest in you by doing that. And it makes you stay in recovery more. Because they're not only investing in you, but they're learning of what you went through and are still going through. And they learn what to look for. Or they learn to have a relapse plan. Or they learn to not talk this way, or they learn to like not be scared to talk around you. But the day I walked in here, my dad took every bottle of alcohol and every beer in the house and he dumped it down the drain, and my dad hasn't had a drink since. Hmm. And my fiance never drank. So it's not an issue.
And I mean, it sounds like pretty tough guy.
Yeah.
And he's had his own recovery of sorts.
Yeah.
And has his own support group.
Mm-hmm.
And is able to support you.
Mm-hmm. And he's actually recently opened up in that group about my mother.
Wow.
And he's never talked about it.
It gives you community.
Yeah.
The power of
it's
community.
Amazing. And then to go like on different events and functions and have fun without alcohol. And
realize there are other families.
Yeah.
That look maybe similar to us or maybe don't look similar to us, yeah. But we're dealing with the same right. disease, the same thought processes.
And to have that and to have your family involved, like if they do a sober bowling and you could bring your family, or if they do the barbecue and you could bring your family, or a picnic at the park or a pirate game, just seeing the people that get out to do that and are able to bring their kids when maybe they can't afford it because there's a lot of people that their addiction put them into a lot of debt that they haven't worked out of yet. And that's kind of what drove me to want to start my nonprofit, is to keep people involved.
So tell me about the nonprofit. Rods for, and it's the number four.
Yeah,
Rods for Recovery.
Correct. So as a hobby, because I always, like whenever I had to retire and everything, my biggest fear was boredom. Mm. Because boredom will lead to drinking. I have a tattoo right there. It says, "Idle time is the devil's workshop."
Mm.
And that's what it's all about. That's my go-to. And there's not a lot of opportunities for people to stay involved in a sober community. And I had a hobby whenever I stuck to it. I build fishing rods for friends and family. I order blanks. They could have any company blank. They could have a $600 blank, or they could have a $20 blank. And I put the eyelets on it and let them pick their color thread. And my thing was, I'm going to put sober dates on fishing rods and make them for people in recovery, because I could order the decals and epoxy around them and make it look like they got it at the store. And as I started thinking about that, I was like, I could make this more. So I thought of Rods for Recovery, and what it's about is using fishing as a therapeutic way in their recovery. So people that don't know how to fish or don't know how to tie the knots. I've gone to a recovery center that has lakes on the property. I did a group on knot tying and rigging rubber worms different ways. Took them out to the lake and they all caught fish and they had a blast. And I had a guy come up to me at the end and say, my son always wanted me to take him fishing and my addiction stopped me, and plus I just don't know how. He goes, I cannot wait to get out of here and take my son fishing.
Wow.
So it's rewarding. So what I'm in the process of doing, and some of it's underway, and I take people fishing, but my board not only is specialized in some sort of fishing, but my board either is in recovery themselves or had a family member. So, I mean, I have my son as a trustee. He's 28 years old, and he was a huge part of my recovery. And he fishes bass tournaments.
That is so cool.
So if somebody wants to go out for the day with him, I'm working on funding, I'm working on donations, I'm working on grants. I want to have a brick-and-mortar building where I could store our equipment, I could have meetings, open discussion meetings about recovery, prayer group before we go out to a fishing thing.
And so I've heard other people describe that fishing, because it was a solo activity, was a real a time when they did drink.
Yeah.
And so to learn with other guys who that's their passion,
right.
and ladies, that they can do it sober.
Yeah.
Talk a little bit about that.
It's more enjoyable when you're sober. I went through the whole drinking and fishing thing, and you know, people drag their lawn chair down to the shoreline of the riverbank and put their cooler next to them, and we've all done it.
Yeah.
But now I want to get into, you're in waders standing in the middle of the water. I'm going to occupy your
looking
mind.
Looking at your fishing rod, yeah. with your sobriety date on there.
Right.
Like, what a reminder.
Yeah. But the equipment that I'm that I'm working on getting through donations and grants and just reaching out to different Bass Pro Shops, Cabela's, Huck is a fishing, is a clothing company mm-hmm. that deals with fishing. Sims is a clothing company. Orvis, one of the guys on my board is, works for Orvis, and he's a fly tying specialist. So if somebody wants to learn how to tie flies, I want to have that brick and mortar place where we have our meetings, and I could have Max come there and set up his fly tying outfit, and they're going to tie fly. Max is an expert, and Max's sister died 2 years ago from an overdose.
So they're all connected.
They're all connected. And he wants to get out there and help people.
Now, if people want to learn more about Rods for Recovery, where can they go to do
that? Right now we're running off a Facebook page.
Okay.
If you go on Facebook and type in Rods for Recovery.
And the four is the numeral four.
It's Rods, the number four, Recovery.
Yep. Rods and, for Recovery.
It's on Facebook, and there's a donation link. There's applications. Memberships are $25 a year. I do ask that you be a member. Mm-hmm. Before we go on any fishing excursions that we're going to use a boat, we're going to use a lot of equipment, and regardless, any fishing adventure I go on, I'm going to involve the drug screen to make sure that people are in recovery. If you want to use my charity and take advantage of what we offer, you're going to do it sober.
Yeah.
I work with UPMC, sends me drug screens, they send me Narcan, they send me xylene strips, fentanyl strips.
It's amazing.
Yeah. So on a quarterly, they just mail the stuff out.
I usually ask, like, what is life like now? 1 year.
Yeah, it's awesome.
You have a nonprofit. Your dad is coming with you to support your recovery.
It's amazing.
Your son is involved.
Oh, every day. I was on the phone with him 2 minutes before I came in here.
Wow.
He was like, good luck on that podcast. He was like, I know who we're walking.
And you have.
But
you had an article in the newspaper this week.
Yeah, if you Google Gazette. If you Google Rods the number four recovery, the top thing is the we had the front page of the health section of the Post Gazette for casting a light on recovery.
That's amazing.
Yeah. So we're just trying to help people one cast at a time, we say.
I think so many people, you've talked a lot about grief. So many people feel, and in the beginning, there is a grief process that comes with losing your substance.
Yes.
And that's been kind of your coping mechanism. That's, in some cases, your best friend. I
learned here something I never knew, and that is you could basically grieve anything. I was told by the grief counselor that was here, I could grieve the loss of my liver when I get a new one. Mm-hmm. It just happens.
And so, what's it like to come through that?
It's
a year later.
Yeah, the feelings,
and be on the other side.
The feelings, the emotions. It's like you go through all these feelings that you used to drown.
Mm.
You know, if you had a bad emotion or a bad feeling or you had anxiety, you would drown it and just not think about it. And now you have to face it and you deal with it. And that's what gave me the drive to do this, is I could get through this. I did this. If I did that, I can do this. Mm-hmm. If I do this, I could do that. And like I said, it started off with, I'll just make a fishing rod for somebody and tell them, go fish and be happy. Mm-hmm. Now I want to take you.
Yeah.
You know, you want to go trout fishing, stand at waders, use a fly rod, use a spinning rod. You want to go on the boat, as long as my son's not in a tournament. And I hope, and I've said this from day one, within due time, I have a boat wrapped in a Rods for Recovery wrap that I will use strictly for Rods for Recovery to take people out.
I love it.
Thanks.
Love it.
So if anybody wants to donate a boat.
Yeah. Hey, there's people out there.
I know. Believe me, I've been knocking. There. Knocking on doors, hugging people, and kissing babies.
Hey, it's for a good cause.
Thanks.
It's for a very
good
cause.
It excites me to know that this could
be. And
really
extra credit if the boat's purple for recovery, right?
The
recovery
wrap,
month.
The wrap.
Right. Yeah.
Because even my, I have table banners that I use at vendor shows, and it's purple.
Purple is the cover of recovery.
My business cards are purple.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, I use purple for everything because it's the recovery color.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
Well, Bill, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for the opportunity.
Any last thoughts or anything
you'd
like to...
If you have a loved one or anyone that needs help, you know, reach out to anyone you know. Reach out to your church. Reach out to, of course, Recovery Centers of America. I cannot stress how much this place has helped me and my family. It's basically saved my life. And I would not, any of this would not be possible without them, without the alumni. Like, I never dreamed that after I got out of a recovery center, I would go back every Tuesday night. And I mean, I'm a year.
And come in to volunteer.
I volunteer. Anything that Patrick has going on with alumni, he knows. He don't even give me the sign up sheet. Just call me. You know, he knows I'm here. And, you know, different shows we go to. And the people that don't go to alumni might be interested in a pirate game. So you might have been inpatient with somebody 2 years ago and hook up with them at a pirate game.
Yeah.
And, you know, I got phone numbers of people that I met in here that I talk to more than my average friends. Because they are my new friends. You change everything. But the one thing you got to do, if you go to a recovery center and you spend 30 days with people or you spend 15 days and they leave, you got to get them phone numbers. Mm. You know, I was talking about Billy before, and me and Billy are tighter than two coats of paint. And we always make sure we talk to one another. And it's just like he said, if we would have known each other 10 years ago or 5 years ago during our hardest days of addiction, we would have not clicked whatsoever. But here we are.
Typically end with favorite recovery quote. Do you have one?
I honestly want to say idle time is the devil's workshop.
Yeah, you have it tattooed. Yeah, you're allowed to say that.
That's what I live by.
Yeah. Keep busy.
Yeah. Yeah, you
gotta
keep
connected.
Busy. Yes. Yeah. And reach out. Mm. You know, reach out. If you might not have got that person's phone number while you were in inpatient, but you might be friends with them on Facebook.
Yeah.
The phone don't weigh 1,000 pounds. Hmm. Everybody thinks it does in recovery, but it don't.
Yeah.
They might appreciate a phone call. They might be looking for that phone call.
Bill, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Listeners, if you or someone you know needs help, please call 1-833-RCA-ALUM. There are people standing by who will take your call that will help you find the right level of care, the right transition plan, and help you find a life in recovery. Thank you so much for joining us. We wish you all the very best.
Thank you for listening to the Strength in Recovery podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, please tap the subscribe button and leave us a review. We love hearing from our listeners and hope to reach more of you out there as we continue to share these incredible stories of recovery. The RCA alumni team aims to provide a safe, supportive environment for those in the recovery community, regardless of their affiliation with RCA. We host a full calendar of virtual and in-person meetings, as well as free sober events every month. To learn more about what we do, find us at rcaalumni.com. Remember, if you or a loved one is struggling with addiction, pick up the phone and dial 1-833-RCA-ALUM. Help is available 24/7. Listen to another episode now, or join us next time for the Strength in Recovery podcast.